This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
Welcome to Rex Factor.
This week, Prince Albert. Review.
With your hosts, Graham Duke and Ali Hood.
Hello.
Hello.
And welcome to Rex Factor, reviewing all the Queen and Prince Consorts of England, from Elswith to Prince Philip. Follow us on Twitter, X and Instagram at Rex Factor Pod, email rexfactorpodcast@hotmail.com, and sign up for bonus content and ad-free episodes at patreon.com/Rex Factor. This week, we are reviewing Prince Albert, consort to Queen Victoria. We did his biography episode last time, but this week, it's all about the scoring on the factors and deciding whether or not he deserves the Rex Factor.
Okay.
Before we get into the ratings, we'll have a quick recap on him to refresh our or Ali's memory.
Biography!
Prince Albert was born on the 26th of August 1819, just 3 months after the birth of his future wife and first cousin, Victoria.
Hmm.
Albert's childhood is disrupted by the affairs of his parents, with his mother sent away from court and dying a few years later without ever seeing Albert again. Serious and studious child, Albert's destiny, almost from the off, is to be Victoria's future husband. First visit to England is a modest success, but a return visit in 1839 is a triumph. Victoria falls madly in love and proposes marriage soon after. Albert is initially frustrated by limitations placed on his role as consort, but with Victoria's frequent pregnancies, Albert is able to become an effective co-monarch, overseeing the royal household, having meetings with government ministers and playing a very public role, promoting various reforming societies and endeavours. However, the incessant hard work and passionate but tempestuous relationship with Victoria takes its toll on Albert, who becomes prematurely aged, probably suffering from depression and a long-term health condition. 1861, increasingly unwell, he develops a fever after a visit to his eldest son following a reported indiscretion, and his condition gradually deteriorates, with Albert dying on the 14th of December 1861 at the age of just 42. So that was Albert's biography. Let's get on to the scoring.
Battliness!
Oh, this is interesting.
Well, Albert's not a military man, of course. He does have a little bit of a legacy in military matters. So when the Duke of Wellington retired as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces in 1852, he proposed that Albert should succeed him in the post.
Why?
Because he's a prominent person.
But he doesn't know the first thing.
Indeed. Albert is also aware of the danger of too overt an intrusion into government affairs by being Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces.
I mean, come on! What are you talking about, Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces? That's equivalent to giving him the nuclear button, isn't it?
Well, he won't be like... It's not like he'll be the Field Marshal directing the military campaign. It's more of an administrative head.
Okay, maybe you're quite good at that then.
Wellington probably thought he'll modernise... Right. In some sort of bureaucratic administrative fashion, like, rather than directing where they put the guns.
But still, like, there's you have to be careful. Like, there's stuff that you just don't know. Like, why are we spending so much on cooks? This is an army.
So he declines the offer, but he does help to create the army's first ever permanent training garrison in Aldershot in 1854.
All right, I take that.
Which is still in use today. Victoria and Albert took a close interest in the garrison and the town that grows around it as a result, so they build the Royal Pavilion where they'd stay when attending reviews of the army, and Albert established and endowed the Prince Consort's Library in 1860 to contribute to the education of soldiers, and so donated 1,000 books and paid both for the construction and day-to-day running costs.
Nice.
Otherwise, Albert's not a man of action or fighting, but in this series on the consorts, we are looking for a sort of fighting spirit.
Yeah.
Independence of action. Agency.
Exactamundo.
And in that case, Albert is ticking all the boxes.
Okay.
So when he came to Britain, the politicians denied him a title or a place in the House of Lords. Victoria refused to share or discuss matters of state with him. And even the royal household is run by Victoria's old governess, Baroness Leysin, who still enjoys great influence over Victoria. They have a private passage linking their rooms. Leysin supervises the court, and with the arrival of the first royal baby, is in charge of the nursery.
Oh, okay. So that's sort of the role that, if the roles were reversed, would be the queen would be, or rather the queen consort would be in charge of the household.
Yeah.
And he hasn't even got that.
Yeah. Now, obviously, you would expect, sort of in a company, you'd expect the consort, I guess, is the executive chair and there's someone doing maybe the day-to-day stuff.
Yeah.
But in this case, Leysin is executive and day-to-day.
Yeah.
And Albert despises Baroness Leysin, so he thought that she had warped Victoria's character as a child.
God.
So it's her fault. She's so all over the place.
This sounds unhealthy atmosphere.
And described her as an old hag, a crazy, stupid intriguer, obsessed with the thirst of power, who regards herself as a demigod.
It's just a simple power struggle, then.
Mm.
But it's quite a small one. When he's setting up Crystal Palace and putting on the world's first international expo, yes. He must think about arguing with the person who arranges when the porridge is delivered. It's very small beer.
Yes, but he's got to deal with the porridge before he can get to the great exhibition.
He's cutting his teeth here.
Exactly.
Poor woman.
So Albert is upset when Leysin appointed to the nursery a physician who'd recently been discredited in a public scandal. And when the first child, Vicky, fell seriously ill in 1842, Albert, very cross about how it's all been organised, he blames Leysin's poor running of everything, and he writes to Victoria, "Dr. Clark has mismanaged the child and poisoned her with calomel, and you have starved her. I shall have nothing more to do with it. Take the child away and do as you like, and if she dies, you will have it on your conscience."
Christ, big words.
Hmm. So reluctantly, Victoria agrees to give way, so Baroness Leysin is persuaded to retire on the grounds of ill health, and thereafter Albert has full control of the royal household.
Okay. I mean, probably right, for the sake of the family, but it's a crazy new world, isn't it, with these prince consorts, not quite prince consorts.
Yes.
Taking on women's work, not being allowed to do that because you're a bloke.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Anyway, battle won. From Albert's perspective. In terms of the monarchy itself, it was again the arrival of children that sort of turns things into Albert's favour. So with the birth of Vicky, the 1840 Regency Act designates Albert as regent in the event of Victoria dying before the child reaches the age of majority. And it empowers him to rule without an advisory council, which actually gives him more power than previous potential regents had had.
Right.
And Victoria's near-constant pregnancies and, as we said, probably postnatal depression limits her capacity to fulfil her duties at all times.
Mm.
So she's intermittently taken out of circulation.
Yeah.
So that obviously gives Albert an opportunity to step into the breach, and he very much delights in the minutiae of public administration, quickly demonstrates his ability to govern effectively.
Right.
So once he's given the chance, everyone's like, oh, actually, he's quite good at this, actually. Mm. He replaces Lord Melbourne as Victoria's private secretary and soon goes from just blotting her papers to actually drafting her correspondence.
Mm-hmm.
And he is essentially making key decisions, either with or indeed for her.
They're probably co-ruling.
Mm. So both in private and in public, they're seen effectively as a dual monarchy. So he sits beside her at the state opening of Parliament. He holds public audiences alongside her. They receive ministers together in private.
Mm. And they know that he speaks for both of them.
Well, indeed. So in 1845, the clerk of the Privy Council, Charles Greville, noted that they were both starting to say, "we think" or "we wish." But in this case, not just meaning the royal we, but literally I and he. And indeed, Greville concluded that they were now one person. And as he likes business, it is obvious that while she has the title, he is really discharging the functions of the sovereign. He is king to all intents and purposes.
Yeah. Everyone seems happy with this arrangement, though.
Hmm. But, you know, from an agency, independence, etc., an influence, he's gone from being denied anything.
Oh, I see what you're saying, yeah.
He's got control of the royal household. He's, at the very least, effectively a dual monarch and probably the dominant force in that. So he sort of managed to make himself in charge.
Oh, without a shot being fired. Although it did help having children.
Yes. So that is all good battliness stuff from a consort perspective, even without being a merchant.
I mean, how do you not score that as a perfect 10?
Well, he's not all-powerful in all things, and he probably would still have felt frustrated at the limitations that he wasn't able to overcome.
Mm.
So Baron Stockmar, whose uncle Leopold's secretary, had overseen the latter part of Albert's education, and he was preparing him to be something of a benevolent dictator. So a modern prince who exercises executive power.
Yeah.
Now, that'd be relevant for sort of the Germanic duchies and a lot of other European monarchies, but it doesn't really appreciate all the changes that have happened in Britain since the Glorious Revolution, in which it's really the politicians who hold the real power.
Yeah.
So, yes, Albert and Victoria do, of course, have an influence, but they're not making the big decisions. So to the politicians, Albert probably seems a bit of an irritant at times.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
So he's important enough that he's on their radar, but not that he can give them orders. Hmm. So he's more he who must not be ignored rather than he who must be obeyed.
Yeah.
So A.N. Wilson wryly noted that when one of the Prime Ministers, Lord Aberdeen, sold Balmoral to Albert, Jeeves himself would have been proud of himself if he had persuaded the workaholic prince to purchase a holiday home almost as far from Westminster as it is possible to be in the main island of Britain.
Jeeves, as in Jeeves and Worcester?
Yeah.
Was he around at that point? Who's this?
Well, no, so it's just... this is an historian looking back and saying, you know, even the arch...
I see, yeah.
...manipulator Jeeves would have had to have doffed his cap at this way of saying, tell you what, why don't you try Balmoral, sir?
Yeah.
It's a bit far away. Yes, it is.
Hone your hunting skills.
And it's probably in foreign policy that Albert's limitations are most evident. So when Aberdeen was Foreign Secretary, even though they got on quite well, the more Albert tried to interfere, the more Albert withheld state papers. So he'd even take to just not sending them to Albert until the decision had already been enacted. Basically just to stop Albert sticking his oar in. Mm. Or if he does stick his oar in, then the boat's already... Albert and Aberdeen actually get on pretty well, but in the 1850s, foreign policy comes to be dominated by Lord Palmerston. Mm. And Albert hates Lord Palmerston. Palmerston is an unashamed rake.
Okay.
So more a sort of regency figure than Victorian when it comes to morals. Right. So he's still very much the charm, the swagger, the ladies. He's a witness in a divorce case in his 80s.
Missed those times.
And he's widely popular in the nation as this jingoistic figure who very proudly pursues British interests first, regardless of anything else. And that's at total odds to Albert's European outlook, who's trying to sort of, you know, further the cause of humanity.
Yeah.
Which Palmerston's like, don't care. It's all about Britain.
It's weird. I'm definitely an Albert and an egg. But I do like those characters. Would have been, imagine that if we'd have had some European cohesion at this point. What would that have done for the trajectory over the 20th century? One to ponder. I mean, doubtless been written about.
So in 1848, Albert is appalled when Palmerston declares his sympathy for the various Republican revolutions and movements that spread across Europe. And then we have the build-up to the Crimean War, where Palmerston really does play on Albert's unpopularity in the country to improve his own position within the government. So he sort of courts popular support very much at Albert's expense.
What a toad.
Despite having counselled against war, when it does come, Albert throws himself into devising strategies for victory. He writes voluminous memoranda, and of course the government just ignores or rejects all of it.
Right. Was any of it sensible?
Oh yeah, and some of it they do actually sort of end up doing, but not because Albert suggested it, just because they try something else and then think, oh, should we do this? Wasn't that Albert's idea? No, didn't read it. Did you read it?
But he can still claim it.
His particular ambition in foreign policy, Albert, is to influence the creation of a unified liberal Germany. Mm. And that is also unsuccessful. So he thought marrying his eldest daughter, whom he's basically trained for the role, marrying the future emperor will be the key to unlocking the door. But he is disappointed in that regard. He writes extensive plans for a new constitution for united Germany. But his ideas, of course, are all ignored. And historians have basically concluded he's just a bit naive in thinking, A, that his sort of young daughter could tip the scales away from Prussian militarism and send them towards constitutional government, liberal values. Obviously, he doesn't know that a Bismarck is about to appear on the scene, but equally, he doesn't really appreciate that he's not actually that influential in what's going on.
It just seems so odd. He's managed to get himself in a position of absolute... in everything but but title, king, living of Great Britain, the dominant force in the world at the time. And right at that moment, he turns around and says, I'm going to start work on Germany. He's got the wrong country. He's working on the wrong passport.
Well, that's what Palmerston thinks.
Yeah, he's in at the helm of Apple, and he's turning around to Microsoft saying, why don't you do it a bit more like this? When he should be plowing ahead and making his own Apple products. Meanwhile, he hasn't taken over. Nokia's still kicking off, and he should be trying to do iPhones.
Mm.
It's a tortured analogy, isn't it?
Yes. But basically, Albert is he's able to exert a lot of influence at home and do various things, but he's not all powerful in all things.
Mm. Well, I think that's just misapplied power. He'd come from a position of being in charge of Braintree District Council, as we call
it. Yes, yes.
To being on the edge of power, everyone saying, no, hang on, let's be careful of this. You are a bloke. We've got to be really careful. Oh, child arrives. He's basically king. Then he goes and starts looking at what's going on in Germany. But okay, he fails there because he's never going to... They don't listen to him in the UK. Why should they listen to him there?
Mm.
So he's done all he can. He's conquered all he can. And now he's just sort of punching at the glass ceiling. I don't think he could ever smash... No one at this point is going to go back in time and have an absolute monarchy.
I guess, though, it's useful, like, if we didn't have those examples, we'd just think, oh, wow, and he just completely took control, and it was just the century of Albert, and his was the only voice that mattered. But actually, when you see the other perspective, it's like, oh, no, actually, there are probably quite a lot of areas of the politicians like, oh, another letter from Albert. Should we reply? No, just do it and then tell him afterwards.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of influence... And he's obviously had to establish that for himself. So, yeah, I think good battliness, but yeah. I guess that there is a limit to it. So he sort of not get too carried away in how influential he is, because clearly...
But in terms of fighting to be in a position where he can even have a voice is pretty good.
And he's still shouting even when they're not listening.
Even when they're not listening. Yeah. I mean, I'm just trying to imagine if the tables were turned and this were a queen consort for to go from Braintree District Council to... Queen of Great Britain and co-ruling with the monarch.
Mm.
Pretty blooming good. And even when no one's listening to her anymore, she's still shouting. I think it's pretty good.
I guess it's different with some of this stuff with the politicians. It's like, is he like this incredibly powerful force? And the politician's like, oh God, Albert, I just can't resist. Or is it that he's just chat, talking, and they say, you know, I think if we just leave the room, he'll probably just carry on and we can just...
But give him a task, like the Great Exhibition, and it goes really well. I see Wellington's point. He'd have been good at it. He was, now that he had the title and the power, wants to do something with it and is depressed that there's a Radiohead lyric about this, but what is it, power, and when you get there, it's so disappointing, yeah.
But in battliness, he does have agency. He does secure a lot of power for himself that was initially being denied for him.
I think it's really, really good.
Mm.
Because, as I say, what else can you do at this time? 8.
Hmm. Yeah, I think 8 probably is fair. It's the 8. It's full on agency. It's taking control where it was being denied to him. I think that's the thing. I think it's the fact that nobody wanted him to have any influence. You've got the politicians not giving him a title. You've got the governor running the household. Yeah. You got Victoria saying, actually, I am the queen, so you keep shtum. And he's like, I don't think so.
And ends up ruling in her stead and does get the title in the end.
Mm. So that's an 8 from you. I will go for an 8. So that's 16 for battliness.
I wasn't expecting that.
Scandal.
Surely none.
It's not really his thing,
Scandal,
but he does manage to outrage the press every now and again. So I'll put it out there for you.
Okay.
Now, many people listening won't have much taste for any form of hunting, but Victorian society was very critical of Albert because he was a bad sport.
Okay.
So instead of using trained hounds lent by Aberdeen again to seek out otters, he just had one of his men bag a live one and then release it for the hounds to catch.
Oh. Oh, I thought you meant he caught one on the riverbank, put it in a bag, said I caught it, and then let it free.
Let it free, but in the imminent company of some hounds specifically raised to catch and dispose of it. And similarly, to give perhaps a better example of this, is when he went to deer stalking, where what you're meant to do, of course, is you track it across miles and miles of mountainous countryside.
Yeah.
What he did was get some keepers just to drive some deer in an enclosed area and then start shooting them.
And this is difficult, isn't it?
Seen as bad sport, and he's criticised in the press for it.
You see, I thought when you said bad sport, I thought you meant bad at sport, not bad sport.
Well, I mean, I guess that's sort of part of it, I suppose, but...
Because that is a bit of... That is bad sport, isn't it? Mm. There's no... Removing the challenge is literally and metaphorically bad sport.
Mm. I guess from his perspective, he's like, well, this is so much more efficient.
Yeah.
The point is to hunt the animal, yes.
Yeah.
So we gather them all together, easy to catch.
Yeah. Put them in a field with sties, and they can live in those, and when we want, we can drive them into factory for slaughter. Yeah. This is much more efficient. Why? That's what I mean. I think that he doesn't like it. It's like he doesn't understand that side of doing things.
Yeah. But nevertheless, it is a task to complete.
Yeah. And because of his character, he ends up doing it in quite a barbaric way, but...
Now, a more exciting bit of bad press came in the build-up to the Crimean War. As we'd said earlier, Albert and Victoria urged a diplomatic solution when Russia attacked a Turkish squadron, the Ottomans, and the Ottomans had got the backing of Britain and France against them, so it all stokes anti-Russian sentiment, which Palmerston very much whips up in the country. And Albert finds himself portrayed in the press as someone without the stomach for war and part of the Austrian-Belgian-Coburg-Orléans clique, plotting with German relatives to keep England out of the war. Rumours even start to swirl that Albert is going to be put on trial for treason.
So the press don't half whip nonsense up, don't they?
So Albert himself confided to Stockmar, "You will scarcely credit that my being committed to the Tower of London was believed all over the country, nay, even that the Queen has been arrested." So generally people were like gathering outside the tower, thinking that Albert was in there.
I mean, this has always been the way, isn't it? The press just banks on the credulity of people.
Mm.
And it always works.
Accurately.
Yeah.
So, obviously, complete and total nonsense. But it was bad enough the House of Parliament did actually have to publicly affirm their trust and gratitude in Albert. Against him, of course, is the fact that he absolutely abhors scandal. He's got a pathological horror at the very notion of promiscuity and shows no interest in any other woman apart from Victoria.
I mean, that. So I think, I mean, scandal, he had scandal thrust upon him, and he batted it away, I think.
Mm.
Is that worth a point?
I don't think I'm going to give him one.
No, me either. It's a zero.
Right, we now move on to consider what I think is his main category of subjectivity, but first, we'll take a quick break.
Subjectivity.
This is where Albert really lays out his stall. This is his factor. He helped fashion a new style of moral monarchy that's still largely the model, really, for the Windsors today.
Yeah.
It sort of feels like this is kind of the beginning of what we would recognise as what the royal family does. So he rejects the dissolute Hanoverians that had gone before. The royal family now will appeal to and lead the middle classes.
Yeah, the newly enfranchised middle classes.
And it does so by presenting itself as middle class. So all these values Albert appreciates. Strong work ethic, close-knit family, self-improvement, thrift.
Yeah,
that's what Albert's going for. So historian Charles Reed has suggested that much of what we think of as Victorian might be better termed Albertism.
Yeah.
It's sort of his character and values,
and then the other
really.
Side of that is the grief, morbid obsessed Victoria, which is the other side of Victoriana.
Yeah.
Victoriana, Victorianism? What's the word there?
Both.
Okay.
So Albert modernises and streamlines the royal finances. So he makes significant developments in the revenues of the Duchy of Cornwall.
Oh, yeah.
Which again, of course, is a major royal wealth today. And other measures. So there's a model dairy farm at Windsor, which quickly turns a profit.
Oh. Not the sort of models I'm into.
Oh, no.
Right.
It's a bit big for
these model. They're very, very realistic cows, I must say. Oh, this is brilliant. The milk is amazing.
But all of these measures mean that the royal family is able to purchase Osborne House on the Isle of Wight and Balmoral in Scotland through their own revenues rather than the public purse.
Oh, nice. Nice, yeah.
They also make for these houses a perfect rural retreat for this virtual family life that Albert wants to create and project. So Balmoral gives the outdoor lifestyle, toughen up the children, while at Osborne House he sets up Swiss Cottage where the children learn cooking, shopping, even firing cannons. So the royal family is seen as providing stability and continuity, really for the first time since the early days of George III and Queen Charlotte.
Oh, yeah.
Also had that big family and tried to present the moral moral picture. So the family stages musical evenings, children put on theatre shows, go to the circus, build snowmen in the winter.
Yeah.
Just your sort of regular family stuff.
Yeah.
So they're doing it, but they're also showing that they're doing it.
Yeah.
So Albert is something of a PR guru.
Hence his meltdown when his son gets caught with a well, prostitute in Ireland.
So he embraces the new technology of photography, so shares informal pictures of the family. So he eschews the sort of traditional images of pomp and pageantry. So they're not shown wearing crowns and all the royal regalia. They're just wearing smart, but, you know, fairly ordinary clothes.
Smart casual.
A QI klaxon Rex factor, Albert, would be to say that he introduces the Christmas tree to Britain.
Oh, you know, I nearly said that earlier.
Well, so it's technically Queen Charlotte, George III's wife that we just mentioned, who first brings it to Britain. But at that point, it was only really customary within royal circles. It's not become a big thing yet, but it's Albert's arrival that really sees the Christmas tree become a popular thing.
Oh, okay. I think that's...
So I think he still can kind of claim...
I reckon he makes it
a thing. He's not the first to introduce it, but he's the person who makes it a thing.
The fact that other Germans have done it before is all right. Hmm. It's just the fact it's that it's catches on in the UK because of him.
Yeah. So the cover of the 1848 Illustrated London News depicts a Victoria and Albert and their small children all gathered around a decorated Christmas tree, presents underneath.
Creepy man with a red hood in the background liggering up the chimney.
But that becomes like the definitive image of what a traditional Christmas scene looks like.
Yeah.
At the time, but I guess also, you know, still there are quite a few of these sort of Victorian cultural things around that period that still...
With an uncle asleep on the sofa after too much Guinness.
Exactly. Well, and Ali slept. However, Albert is by no means just style over substance, so he saw the monarchy as having a central role in steering the nation through this period of extraordinary change, so he advocates for new technologies, but also with a social conscience.
Yeah, I like him.
So one of his first ventures into public life comes in 1840, when he becomes the president of the Society for the Extinction of Slavery.
Nice.
So Britain had abolished the slave trade in 1807 and slavery... overall as a concept in 1833, but it's still lawful in most of the world outside of the British Empire, so French Empire, Spanish, Portuguese, etc. So, you know, so many prominent members of British society and indeed, you know, the politicians are still actively engaged either in owning slaves or the slave trade in a way.
Slaves.
Mm.
People.
Yes. So it's not sort of preaching to the converted here. This isn't completely after the fact and it's just, you know, a pointless endeavour. It is still an active issue. Even though Britain has illegalised the trade, etc.
I guess like a tobacco, if you're they're talking about banning it an age, so no one born after a certain date can buy them. So you'll still have people smoking or something.
Yeah.
And people very much engaged in it.
So he stated in his opening speech as president, "I deeply regret that the benevolent and persevering exertions of England to abolish that atrocious traffic in human beings have not as yet led to any satisfactory conclusion. But I sincerely trust that this great country will not relax in its efforts until it has finally and forever put an end to a state of things so repugnant to the spirit of Christianity and the best feelings of our nature."
Yeah, well said.
Albert has a passion for education, and in 1847 he's elected as Chancellor for Cambridge University.
It sounds great, Graham. this is exactly what I mean. He has a chance to exert his... passions.
Do some stuff.
Yeah.
He probably misunderstands the nature of the role, so usually it would be a ceremonial appointment, but obviously Albert's like, right, well, this
Where's
is the job.
Office?
What am I going to do? Yeah. So he finds that compared to Bonn, where he had studied, Cambridge, in fact, everywhere in Britain, has got a very limited approach to further education. It's quite stuck in the past. So they only really teach mathematics and classics.
Yeah.
So other subjects are on the syllabus, but they're actually taught, while science lectures are voluntary.
Yeah.
So Albert intervenes to ensure that a much fuller syllabus is taught and also greatly expands the reach of the university. So previously they only had like sort of 40 undergraduates reading for honours schools, but he calculates the rents and the monies coming in for all of the colleges, works out all the logistics, proposes foundation fellowships be made available to all, and so they're now able to fund sort of 600 to 700 places for poor students.
I mean, this is great stuff.
And obviously where Cambridge leads, the others follow. So suddenly you've got much more varied syllabus and all the universities are kind of opening up a little bit more.
The exponential impact that has had.
Mm.
That's amazing. Golly.
Now, although by temperament, a political conservative. Albert has a highly developed social and class consciousness, and he's quite passionate about improving the lives of the working classes and giving them the means to improve their own lives. So he bemoaned the failure of the education system to reach half of Britain's children and sought to raise public awareness of the evil of child labour. So he supported Lord Ashley's Mines and Colliers Bill, which increased the age at which children could work down the mines. So in 1848, the year of revolutions across Europe, Albert becomes the president for the Society for the Improvement of the Condition of the Labouring Classes.
As in, don't kill me, I'll make stuff better, club.
Yes. So in his opening speech, he expressed his sympathy and interest for that class of our community who have most of the toil and fewest of the enjoyments of this world, saying it was the duty of those who, under the blessings of divine providence, enjoy station, wealth and education to assist those less fortunate. The interests of classes too often contrasted are identical, and it is only ignorance which prevents their uniting for each other's advantage. To dispel that ignorance, to show how man can help men, notwithstanding the complicated state of civilised society, ought to be the aim of every philanthropic person. Let them be careful, however, to avoid any dictatorial interference with labour and employment, which frightens away capital.
I'm inspired.
So it's very much, this is really definitive Victorian free market economy, but with a bit of a social conscience. So yeah. It's not replacing the status quo. He doesn't want to overhaul everything and have socialism. It's more making it as just as possible.
Yeah, brilliant.
So within this particular society, Albert developed schemes for building sanitary and affordable housing for workers.
Good.
Albert was a workaholic, and there is a sense of him sort of working himself to death.
Yeah, maybe this is why I like him.
And that's best exampled on the 1st of December 1861, when he was dying, but there was work to be done.
You've got to turn up for Tuesday talks.
So Britain declares neutrality in the American Civil War, but could have been dragged into it when the Southern Confederacy sent two envoys to Europe on a British ship, the Trent, only for a federal, i.e. the Northern, Lincoln's bit, warship, to intercept the ship and remove the envoys.
In a malicious manner?
Well, however malicious it was, it's a neutral British vessel that has been intercepted by an American ship, which causes outrage in Britain. It's seen as an attack on a British vessel, on a neutral vessel.
And we rule the waves, thanks very much.
We rule the raves. Yeah. The raves. We rule the waves. Palmerston's Prime Minister.
Oh, dear.
The Foreign Secretary, Lord John Russell, prepares a response which is rather bellicose in nature.
Well, was it gunboats?
It's not quite gunboats. They're not quite as aggressive. They are a little bit like, let's not be too hasty.
Right.
But we are cross. But when Victoria shows Albert the draft, Albert exclaims, "This means war!" So gets out of his sick bed, rewrites Russell's ultimatum, and changes it to far more diplomatic language. So he suggests the American captain must have been acting on his own initiative rather than on orders, and thus gives Abraham Lincoln the scope to apologise, but without losing face.
Well, that's grown up.
I'm sorry that this has happened, but it wasn't what we ordered to happen. It was this one reckless chap. Palmerston thought the language excellent and largely just keeps what Albert writes and just changes the tense and etc. to make it a government response rather than Albert's advice.
Right.
And it worked. So the US backed down, apologised for the captain's precipitate actions and released the invoice.
What were they doing anyway? Like what?
So the Confederate envoys are going to come to Europe and try and get recognition for the South as a separate nation.
Oh, British ship was taking the Confederate envoys.
It's not that the British ship is taking them, it's just a British ship, and right, the envoys get on it.
Yeah.
So it's not that they are official guests, they just bought.
Oh, I totally understand their actions then.
Yeah. So a very successful intervention by Albert, and he does all this despite the fact that he's wretchedly ill. So he told Victoria that he couldn't eat breakfast and admitted, "I'm so weak I've hardly been able to hold the pen." And indeed, Victoria later notes in the margins, "This draft was the last the beloved prince ever wrote." Yeah. So it's sort of his last sort of state action is kind of to avert a war with America.
Oh, man, what a hero.
Perhaps Albert's greatest triumph, however, came a decade earlier with the Great Exhibition in 1851.
Yeah.
So in 1843, Albert becomes president of the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufacturers and Commerce.
Yeah.
As I said, all lovely big long names. And that begins to have annual exhibitions of manufacturers. So in 1849, it was suggested they should expand their outlook to be more international in character. So it's not Albert's idea, but he agrees to it and embraces it. So he sees this as an opportunity to define Britain's global status and to provide a sense of hope and inspiration for the future.
OK. Cool, yeah.
But there's a lot of pessimism in the country about the whole enterprise. It's said that the lower orders will riot, foreigners and revolutionaries will overrun London, the elm trees at Hyde Park will be destroyed by whatever building they put in place. The building designs shared in the press are all terrible. It's essentially the Millennium Dome of its day.
Yeah, utterly.
For those in the UK.
That's such a dated reference.
I know it is. Lady Littleton noted that the whole affair was quite universally sneered at and abominated by the beau monde and will only increase the contempt of the prince among all fine folk. Lord Broome claimed that someone in Albert's peculiar position should have the sense to know that repose and inaction is his only security against ridicule.
Just do, stop now while you can.
Whilst King Ernest Augustus of Hanover even suggested Victoria should be removed from London for her own safety.
Because he's going to stick up a greenhouse and fill it with steam engines.
Yes.
God.
As Albert wrote to the King of Prussia, slightly sarcastically, mathematicians have calculated that the Crystal Palace will blow down in the first strong gale. Engineers at the galleries would crash in and destroy the visitors. Doctors, though owing to so many races coming in contact with each other, the Black Death of the Middle Ages would make its appearance. Theologians that this second Tower of Babel would draw upon it the vengeance of an offended God. I can give no guarantee against all these perils.
Good. Really good to lance that spoil of superstition and bad science. Though I take the point about suddenly transferring a load of disease.
Yeah, I suppose, yes. A lot of people in one place is always a vector for disease. But he jokes, but it is an exhausting process. He has to help oversee the whole project and raise funds to pay for it all. So Victoria contributes £1,000 and Albert himself £500, but it's a very slow process. Albert's ridiculed in Punch magazine, so he's shown cap in hand as the industrious boy begging for money. But the persistence paid off. So after 245 architectural plans had failed to solve the problem of how to house the exhibition, the day is saved when Joseph Paxton presents a design based on a conservatory, on a greenhouse that he built at Chatsworth for the Duke of Devonshire, but on a much, much grander scale. So it's a prefabricated building of iron and 300,000 panes of glass. Covers 18 acres of parkland. So it's 1,848 feet long, 108 feet high, three times the size of St Paul's Cathedral.
Really?
Wow. Absolutely huge building. Easily encompasses the beloved elm trees.
Oh, yes. I remember seeing pictures of it with trees inside. I really like him, Graham. This is essentially my job, begging for money all day. Persevering, because that's all you can do.
And appropriately for what the Great Exhibition was, this is easily the most advanced building of the Victorian age.
Good for him. He's a visionary.
Punch, showing unusual enthusiasm, is the one that dubs it the Crystal Palace, and that catches the public imagination, and that's how it's known. Impressively, given its scale and complexity, the design was approved after just 9 days. Concrete foundations laid after 7 weeks, and just 4 months later, built. And there was now a great public enthusiasm for the exhibition. So nearly 2 miles of exhibition space of over 100,000 exhibits and 14,000 exhibitors across Britain, the Empire, and Europe.
Does he manage to do all this without an I told you so?
I think so. He's just getting on with the job, isn't
he? Good man.
Schweppes, world's first soft drink company, sponsored the event.
Right. It's quite naive and charming to assume that everything was just put on and it wasn't covered in promotion. But it's like the Flora London Marathon or something now. It's always been.
Items on display include a precursor to the fax machine.
It didn't. Well, you've read that wrong.
daguerreotypes, which are an early form of photography. The world's first voting machine. World's first modern pay toilets. Colt's revolver. The trophy telescope, so named for its great size. And demonstrations of industrial processes, kind of in full. So the production of cotton apparently was particularly popular. They had all the machines set up so you could watch the whole thing, how they
that
make stuff.
Brilliant.
Electric telegraphs, microscopes, air pumps, barometers, even some examples of Albert's model housing for workers.
That's more like it. Oh, no, hang on.
Model houses, as in example houses.
Yeah, good.
It feels like the defining pinnacle of the Victorian age is its most grand and ambitious, ushering this new age of advancement and progress. You're right at the forefront of everything.
That's right. And the trouble is, that's what killed him, isn't it? He overworked, and he had to. He was just so full of Victorian stuff. He popped.
Yeah.
He had it at home from Victoria. Yeah. He had it at work being Victorian.
Yes.
And it was just too much. He and I've said he's like me all the way through. It was too much for him.
Yeah.
He couldn't take that much Victoria. He just popped.
He just popped.
You're going to have to be careful, Graham. How many episodes are we doing this?
It's the first of 12 Alberts. And the whole thing was extremely popular. So around 6 million people attended across the 140 days it was open from May to October 1851, which represents about a third of the population.
Wow.
And this was in part due to the approach taken to ticket prices. So sort of from Monday to Thursday, they dropped tickets prices after a while to 1 shilling, which is very affordable for working class visitors. So like an agricultural labourer gets about £20 a year.
Don't know what any of this is.
No, but one is much smaller than the other. So okay. basically, everyone Cheaps. Could go.
Okay.
If you had a job, if you earned money, you would be able to afford to go at some
Unlike
point.
The Millennium Dome.
There was an average daily attendance of over 40,000. It peaked over 100,000 in one day, week before closing. Now, Ian Wilson noted that while some have characterised Albert as sort of a frustrated politician, he's shown here very much in his best light as a sort of civil servant in a coronet.
Yeah.
Highly effective and professional, good manager, but also able to collaborate well on a major project.
Yeah.
And it was finally an opportunity for Albert to get some love. So while he's never fully accepted by the upper classes and elements of the press, he's much more popular in the provinces. So meeting working and professional people, he gets a bit more love and recognition. Clearly biased, but Victoria notes in her diary after the grand opening, "It was the greatest day in our history and the triumph of my beloved Albert."
Oh.
And the Great Exhibition has a very impressive legacy. So for one, it inspired a series of world fairs, or world's fairs, across Europe. More impressively, it's run so effectively, it actually turns a profit of £186,000.
Blimey.
That's something like £33 million in 2023.
God almighty.
Which for a huge infrastructure, exhibition project, etc.
Well, it's good for the people that did back it, presumably got a nice return.
Mm-hmm. And Albert is determined to put the money to good use. So the organising committee, the Royal Commission for the Exhibition of 1851, unusually decides to just keep on going. So it changes its focus to be on increasing the means of industrial education and extending the influence of science and art upon productive industry.
Right.
So the body still operates today. So Princess Anne is the current president.
No!
It's got an HQ in Imperial College, and since 1891 has provided postgraduate scholarships for students to study in Britain and abroad. So 13 Nobel Prize laureates have been in receipt of funding from this group. Annually awards 3-year research scholarships to 8 young scientists or engineers of exceptional promise to be held anywhere in the UK, but it's open to everybody. And also, you know, fields of science, charitable disbursements of more than £2 million a year.
Blow me over.
But even more impressively than that, Albert directs the immediate use of profit from the Great Exhibition to buy up land in South Kensington, as he put it, and place on it institutions to the furtherance of the industrial pursuits of all nations. Now, these are largely all built after his death, because obviously he dies only 10 years later, but all very much his ideas and what he wanted. So these are some of the most notable educational institutions in London. So the V&A, Science Museum, Natural History Museum, National Gallery, Imperial College London, and quite a few others as well. They're all built in this area that Albert has bought up to say, let's use the money from the Great Exhibition and put on all of these great institutions.
I'm liking this, Graham. I'm liking it a lot.
Now known as South Kensington, at the time it was dubbed by the press Albertopolis.
Wicked.
Partly satirical, but also acknowledgement of the fact that this is very much his legacy.
Yeah, nice.
And that is quite a legacy.
Have you got any negative?
I do. Despite all of the good stuff we've just gone through, Albert's never particularly popular in the country. So he continues to be seen as an outsider, this sort of German know-it-all telling everyone what to do, never really adapts to English cultural norms, even speaking German in private. Even the fact that he's in charge of his family's daily life and takes a close interest in his children is sort of rather odd. So you have one caricature depicts him being surrounded by offspring tugging helplessly at Victoria's petticoats.
This is just the xenophobia that exists in this country, or is we're told by the press.
One of our great and proudest traditions.
Yeah. It's just constantly there, because you could swap that out for any other new foreign member of the royal family.
Yes, so a lot of this is just sexism and xenophobia, but there's also some disquiet at how Albert approaches his role as consort from a more political perspective. So David Kennedy and historians argue that Albert wanted to be a sovereign who governed as well as reigned, while Disraeli, Prime Minister believed that he intended to establish court influence on the ruins of political party with perseverance equal to that of George III and talent infinitely greater.
Yeah.
So some historians have even suggested his death comes at quite an opportune moment, and that speculating in sort of counterfactual history that a longer-lived Albert could have set the monarchy on a collision course with Parliament if he was trying to exert more and more influence and control when the direction of travel is that Parliament is sovereign. And particularly if, you know, if he's still grumpy and overworked, maybe his judgment wouldn't have been as good. But also seems a bit unfair to criticise him for...
Dying.
Or I suppose we're praising him for dying. Maybe he did a good thing. He died. It's an unfulfilled thing that might have happened. Equally, he might have recognised it and avoided it. We said how, you know, he didn't take on the army job because he thought that's a bit too much, isn't it? Indeed, some of the politicians who've been critical of Albert ended up full of praise. So Palmerston, who's Albert's bête noir in the 1850s, when he becomes Prime Minister at the end, they get on a little bit better. So he says, "I had no idea of his possessing such eminent qualities. How fortunate it has been for the country that the Queen married such a prince." And on his death, Disraeli declared, "With Prince Albert, we have buried our sovereign. This German prince has governed England for 21 years with a wisdom and energy such as none of our kings has ever shown."
I mean, he's good, isn't he?
Now, always going to be a risky territory for this period, but while many of Albert's values are very sympathetic to a modern audience, his views on imperialism are not. So Albert, like Victoria, takes a lot of pride in Britain's imperial expansion, has something of an evangelical belief in the benefit of British rule for all humanity. So he looked to, you know, the banning of the Sarti, provision of canals, railways and schools. You know, and at times he does have a sort of, tries to have a more liberal influence. So he's appalled by the practices of the East India Company, advocates leniency after the 1857 Indian Rebellion, and also creates the Star of India to reward Indian princes loyal to the crown, which is the only sort of imperial sort of honour that is created.
Given that the empire was happening, his focus seems to be on what it can do to help rather than it being like exploitative.
But he does fundamentally believe, though, that the natural state of affairs is foreign rule. So the Indians are not a people capable of conquering independence for themselves, to say nothing of maintaining it. Our supremacy rests purely upon the circumstances that we protect the different races and populations against mutual ill usage, that we place the poorest and meanest upon the same level before the law as the most powerful, and ensure justice with unimpeachable fairness. Oppression is out of the question.
Was he just blind to it then?
So this thing, so again, that sort of shows, you know, his intentions are sort of good there. Yeah. He's talking about, you know, make sure it's all fair and just, etc. But
Aborigines.
Yeah, he is blind to the violence, cultural insensitivity, and though he does deny it, obviously, oppression.
Yeah.
Is oppression. So as Charles Reid put it, his liberal and evangelical belief in British rule justified the existence and expansion of a destructive empire, and his curiosity and armchair scholarship resulted in the violent colonial expropriation of artefacts and other meaningful objects. So, you know, the Great Exhibition is very much a demonstration of British imperial might, and one of its prize exhibits is the infamous Koh-i-Noor diamond.
Yeah, yeah.
When Albert advocates why it needs to be an international outlook for the event, he explicitly, though obviously unwittingly, references the iniquities of imperialism. "The product of all quarters of the globe are placed at our disposal, and we have only to choose which is the best and cheapest for our purposes."
Right, what's tricky here is that, imagine this were Edward I, and he staged the Great Exhibition. We go, that is blooming incredible. At that time, he's brought the world together.
Yeah.
Okay, so it wouldn't be a question of question of exploitation at that time. It's just sort of standard. It's really lucky that looking at this from a 21st century perspective, looking back on Albert, even though this terrible stuff was happening, we can hope, if he's just blind and naive to it, at least he's going in with like this 21st century values, but it's just resulting in an absolute storm of terrible, like the absolute opposite. Is he protected from it? He just doesn't know that this stuff is happening.
I guess he must know some of this stuff is happening, but I guess it's, again, it's the why he thinks it's happening or what he thinks has gone wrong. So in India, he thinks, oh, it's been administered badly, that's why. Obviously, they all love empire, it's just we've messed it up. So again, he thinks we've got to find a fairer way to govern, because obviously this is the right... Obviously, us governing is the natural state of affairs, but we've obviously not done it right.
Right, okay. You sort of tie yourself up in knots, so you're like a...
Well, obviously, the first step is that imperialism is the best way to go. So let's think how the rest of it needs to fit together, because something's not quite...
Keeps ending up being with oppression, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. So Marx and Engels both saw the Great Exhibition as a celebration of how industrialised nations exploit weaker nations into economic dependency.
Mm. Oh, right. Mm. They, of course, they're around. They're writing at this time. 1851,
the Great Exhibition. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's an awkward one because obviously imperialism is a bad
it's the
thing.
Problem. Yeah.
But equally,
but the,
what coming
I meant
from it from a better perspective than many.
Yes, which is where I think it's helpful reviewing him from the point of view of the 21st century, because that different point of view from many is more similar to our current one.
Finally, some have argued that Albert is something of a domestic tyrant, or rather a familial tyrant.
Oh, this is getting harder, isn't it?
So almost seeing his treatment of Victoria as emotional abuse.
Oh.
So you often groan when Victoria comes up in episodes or mentions, etc. But the thing is that actually the young Victoria was fun-loving, playful, quite, you know, vivacious. Ian Wilson said there's a bouncing exuberance about young Victoria. Her energy, her appetite, her passion for dancing appeared boundless. Mm. But for Albert, all of these things are character flaws that he kind of wants to iron out.
Yeah.
So he entered the marriage with concern at the reports of her being incredibly stubborn, having heard that she delights in court ceremonies, etiquette, and trivial formalities. These are gloomy prospects.
Yeah, so he sort of knocks that side out of her.
Mm. So from the off, he sort of isolates her from bad influences, like Melbourne and Baroness Leys and the governess, and establishes himself as the only significant figure in her life, and thus is able to sort of tame the shrew, as it were.
Well, that's quite, yeah, I can see that that's a very damaging way to be in any relationship.
She's not always compliant, so she does sometimes rage at Albert, but usually over kind of very trivial, minor complaints, quite something small, and she'll blow up. But he lacks the emotional intelligence to understand or sympathise, so as I said, postnatal depression, there probably is some sort of hidden resentment within her at how he's taken over, and the fact that he doesn't return the overt devotion that she gives to him. So he confides in one letter, not to her obviously, "Victoria is too hasty and passionate. She will not hear me out, but flies into a rage and overwhelms me with the reproaches of want, of trust, ambition, envy, etc., etc." So instead of engaging with her when she gets upset, Albert just walks away, locks himself in his room and writes her a letter about everything she's done wrong. So often he'll even address them like dear child.
God, that's so patronising, isn't it?
So this one from 1853, from the next room. "I try my best to be patient, but I feel the dreadful waste of my precious time and of energies which should be turned to the use of others in mere and long recriminations."
Mm.
So she's upset about things and wants to talk, and he's like, "But I'm a very busy man."
They're both so damaged, aren't they? We all are.
So gradually he chips away at her flaws until she becomes the sort of serious, austere and slightly dour Victoria of the public imagination. So one diary entry she writes, "I feel how sadly deficient I am, and how oversensitive and irritable, and how uncontrollable my temper is when annoyed and hurt. Have I improved as much as I ought? I fear not. Again and again I have conquered this susceptibility, have formed the best of resolutions, and again it returns to the annoyance of that most perfect of beings, my adored husband."
It sounds bad, doesn't it?
So when he dies, she's almost being de-skilled by his dominance, so she's all sort of unable to cope. But actually, she's the one that proves to be more robust. She's the one that carries on. She's the one that ultimately dominates. And she, you know, it's in many ways the making of her, the Empress of India, the omnipresent matriarch that defines the ages, very much a post-Albert creation, and the one that would never have occurred if he'd lived.
It's almost like that's his... he was doing all this good stuff, but his other legacy was this version of Victoria that we then were left with.
But I guess it was sort of in defence of Albert. It's obviously it's a 21st mindset seeing that version of it. But like you said, they're both damaged. And the flip side, when we did biography, we probably saw it a bit more from his perspective, which was he's
over Victorian,
cold, rational being, and she's full of emotion, which he doesn't understand, and it just exhausts him. And she throws so much at him and demands overt love and all of this, and she puts him up on this pedestal. So my most perfect adored husband isn't because he's like, "You will worship me as your God." He sort of wants to be in charge because he's the man and the husband, but equally it's quite exhausting for him that he's put on this pedestal because he's like, "This isn't really what I'm about."
And like all relationships have when you're to break them down, there's extremes that magnify and Maybe actually they're rubbed along all right. I don't know.
So it's tricky. So sort of on one way, if we were to, summarise his those sort of areas of negatives, we could say tyranny, imperialism and domestic abuse. But I'm not sure that that's an entirely fair characterisation of him.
When you try and introduce any grey area into any element of those three things,
yes,
you're immediately going to be accused of siding with the bad guys on Twitter.
Mm.
But we've got to be objective here.
Mm.
There's so much good stuff. I mean, even that broadening of Cambridge areas of studies, in terms of effect, just incredible.
Speaking up for the abolition of slavery, sort great of gets execution. Out of his deathbed to prevent war with America, the Great Exhibition and the incredible legacy, he said the money to Nobel laureates, all of those incredible museums in South Kensington is all sort of from the money that, and he says, let's spend it basically on this.
Yeah.
It's his idea.
Yeah, yeah. Like, okay, and the Great Exhibition in itself. It's the ultimate expression of Victorianism. Looking for European unity.
Yeah. It's one of those where you sort of have to put the negative across. I don't know if it's all entirely fair. I feel it feels to me a bit more like it might make you like him less, but not necessarily that his
score should be
his
less.
Legacy as consort is any less. And I think certainly if you're looking at this for a subjectivity, would you want to be a subject? What is his legacy as a consort
incredible.
For Britain? I don't think any of those negatives really affect that legacy as a consort.
Because that's given me all the reason I need to give him the big fact 10.
We've never had a 10 for subjectivity. We discussed that recently. No one's ever had 4 marks for subjectivity. But I just think the sheer weight of stuff that he does, which, as we said, is not too under...
We haven't had anyone with a 10.
No one's ever... Well, I think maybe you... I don't know if you've done it and I've gone a 9 or something. But no, 19's the highest ever.
Oh, right.
I think, if we're looking at that and thinking, has anyone... Of all the ones that we've done before, we had better subjectivity. I don't think so. I feel like that's the best example we've got.
It feels like it went straight to 10, and I didn't know that no one had got 10. So it feels like that's a very, very true response. And I'll let you tell me if anyone has.
So that is the perfect 20 for subjectivity.
Oh, brilliant. So we've done it.
We've done it. Well done, us.
Longevity.
Albert is consort from the 10th of February 1840 to the 14th of December 1861. 21.83 years, which gives him a score of 14.5.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, so it's 17th best overall. So obviously the fact that it's a lot less than Victoria, it feels like, oh, he wasn't there for very long. But actually, he's still there for 20 years, which is pretty...
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Dynasty, not the programme.
Albert has 9 children by Victoria, all of whom survive him. Don't all survive Victoria, but they do all survive him. So that gives him a score of 18 for Dynasty. So third best overall, level with Matilda of Flanders.
And better than Victoria?
Yes, because Victoria does outlive a couple of her children.
Golly, he's going to do really well, isn't he?
Well, yeah, so 18 for Dynasty, so that's a total score for Albert of 68.5, which places him, he's in 6th position overall. So he's just half a mark behind Matilda of Flanders.
I'm surprised it's a...
Well, it's because he got that 0 for the scandal. That's all that's holding him back.
If he'd have got a 10, let's give him a round
10.
Then
he's at 78.5, which would put him in third. I think he'd be still behind... Yeah, third. So behind Isabella of France and Ella of Aquitaine.
That seems fine.
But of course, it's not all about the scores. Does he have that certain something, the lasting legacy, the great achievement and star quality that we call...
Rex Factor!
I think this is trickier than I expected.
Okay, go on.
Well, I mean, it's a yes, but he wouldn't wanted any of it. But the star quality and lasting legacy, I mean, it's massive, isn't it? It's a definite yes.
Shapes the monarchy, sort of a blueprint for today. Wide range of impressive stuff, some of which, like the Great Exhibition, still have a pretty amazing legacy. Charles Reed said he did more to remake and reinvent the British monarchy than any modern consort. Stanley Weintraub said his mark upon Britain is far greater than most monarchs. While Ian Wilson claims there's no other figure in British royal history of comparable ability, breadth, or benign influence who even touches him.
Yeah. Well, hence our big old subjectivity score. I mean, difficult because he wasn't the power and people didn't like him.
Yeah, and he still sort of doesn't feel like he's a particularly popular figure. Which I said, I think partly is because Victoria just makes everyone sick of him.
Yeah, I think that's it. The star quality bit, is almost just becomes Victoria going on rather than it being deserving of all these monuments. And
yes, he doesn't. In a way, he sort of doesn't have much star quality, I guess, would be the
that's the
way
against
him.
Struggling.
That's the his one negative bit, is that he is a bit more civil servant. He's not very glitzy or starry.
If he were given that opportunity, if he were king, say, it would be star quality, because he would be going around doing this with a bigger crown, with a big crown on his head.
With a crown on
with
his head.
With a crown, yeah. As it is, everyone's like, well, he's, you know, but he's not king. But he's, yeah, well, maybe became consort then, yes, but he's not king. I think he definitely has it.
The star quality does matter, but I think the other things can substitute for that. And I think when we're looking at it from the vantage point of modernity, I think the other stuff sort of gives him its star quality in a way. It's the effective, efficient range of stuff that he does. Yeah, it's very impressive. It's one of the most notable. He's one of the most notable consorts, isn't he? Certainly, I say, of the modern ones, but generally I think he is one of the big hitters.
I mean, all the good stuff of Victorian Britain is that side of the monarchy.
Yeah.
And the drudgery bits and the mourning and the... Or is that unfair?
It's unfair to say that all the good things are Albert and all the bad things are Victoria, because like some of the slightly more toxic elements of their relationship... Which it does feel like it goes both ways, that element. Like you can see how it's sort of, she sort of drains the life force out of him to a certain extent. But equally, but equally, that the sort of the dour Victoria is kind of his creation. It's almost like her mourning is sort of like that was the fulfillment of.
Yeah, and it sucks his legacy as well.
Mm. But then ultimately she reemerges. So in a way, you mean, you know, they're a Rex Factor winning pair, and I guess she does have a bit more about her in that sense than him. Yeah. It's a good... Yeah. You take away some of the slightly toxic edges on both of them, she could have been a little bit more calm and rational if he could be a little bit less sort of manipulative and controlling, cold and rational. They'd be a very effective pair, with him being very detail-focused and administration, her being a little bit more vivacious and flamboyant. If they'd been able to capture both aspects of them, then you've really got a great pairing. They probably ultimately went completely one way and then from the other, but...
They're the original Sid and Nancy.
So, that is it. Albert does have the Rex Factor. Well done to Prince Albert. He gets the Rex Factor, the first male Rex Factor winner of the series.
And subjectivity champion.
Correspondence Corner.
So, that was Prince Albert. Let us know what you thought about him, whether he deserves the Rex Factor. You can find us and message us on Twitter or X and Instagram, where we are at Rex Factor Pod. Email rexfactorpodcast@hotmail.com or go to rexfactorpodcast.com, the website, for more information and links to everywhere. Remember to send in a hashtag consort card for an episode image of Albert. And if you would like to support the podcast, subscribe and review us on whatever podcast provider you use, and donate to join the Privy Council, get access to loads and loads of bonus episodes as well as ad-free versions of the main podcast at patreon.com/RexFactor, and of course access to our Discord chat
server. Discord, if you don't know what it is, it's just, it's like a, do you know what it reminds me of? Chat rooms. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Do you know what it reminds me of? Itself.
Well, there you are.
And we have some new Privy Councillors to welcome to the fold.
Deborah Dolby, Laurie Mahoney, Lisa Walker, Victoria Damrell, Kerry O'Grady, Patrina Simonson, Jennifer Latto, Rebecca Michelson, Emily Cooper, Tim Corner, Katrina Duchess of Kansas, Susan Oldfield, Tabitha Rowden, Angela Lewis, Holly Hegarty, Emily Cullis, Elizabeth Walker, Kelly O'Brien, Laura Esselmott, Ben Vermeulen, Jane McShane, Emily Johns, Denise Perez, Kada Ozak-Dogan, and Amanda Palin.
Lovely. Arise, one and all. Do you know what I was thinking then? Is if I were to write a book, like a novel, and I had to come up with names... for the characters, they always, if I like have to use an example of someone, they always sound implausible. But they're real names, these
people. They are real names.
I'm not saying they've all got mad names. I just mean that if I were to say, right, I'm writing a book, it's about, and I'm not going to choose a specific one, pick on them, but I'd say Jeanette Fields. It just sounds stupid. Whatever I choose. So I'll just use her X Factor fan for my novel.
Yes, and we should say for data protection purposes that, of course, Ali will not be using your name for commercial ventures.
Oh, dear. Was Jeanette Fields wasn't one of those, was it?
No.
If you are called Jeanette Fields, I think really think you should.
Well, if you are called Jeanette Fields, you're in my book.
Yeah. You've got to step up and PC yourself.
So that is all for us today, and that is all for Prince Albert. Next time we'll be doing our write reply episode for the Hanoverian Consort. So let us know if you've got any thoughts or questions, whether it be Albert or Sophia Dorothea, Caroline of Brunswick, etc., all of the ones that we've been doing. Let us know. We'll cover that, and then we've got a few interview episodes with historians coming out. Gareth Russell on The Palace, which is a book about Hampton Court. Penelope Caulfield has written the book The Georgians.
Lovely.
And Gretchen Gazina has written a book about Black Britons in the Georgian period.
Nice.
And then after that, I'll start the research for the final mini-series of the series, The Windsors.
We're there. Look at that.
We're there. Next time with the consorts, it will be the 20th century.
No, of course. We're in the same... No, we're not we're in not. The same sense, but, you know, yeah.
See you next time.
Cheerio.